So, last October, we hosted a conference here at Church of All Nations, and our guest preacher today was a keynote speaker there, Ched Myers. Now, because he's from California and his blood runs thin, it was a gorgeous day, but he was all bundled up in his snowmobile suit. I mean, but as I recall, I was wearing shorts that day, but well, we told him to come back in the spring when, you know, he could handle it. So, last October was the first time I'd ever met Ched. I had heard of him, and to be honest, there wasn't really that much that I was impressed with prior to that. You know, he's authored books, he's a world-renowned speaker, but as an indigenous person, I have very many allies. I have fewer colleagues in this fight. But when Ched preached on that Sunday, and we had spent the weekend together, and I had been telling Ched about the stories that exist beneath our feet, and during his sermon, I heard recounts of those stories come out. I could tell that Ched was a man who was deeply conscious and aware of the indigenous stories that surround all of us. And not only conscious and aware, but he allows it to shape his life. And that's when I considered Ched to be a very impressive individual, and indeed a friend. So, friend, it is my pleasure to welcome you to Church of All Nations.
I think we're going to try this like this, so I could just make sure that we're not showing cartoons up there or something, you know. Thank you, Jim Bear, and thank you, Church of All Nations, for... I can now cross you off the very long list of places where I've been invited once. It is truly good to be back. And also, yes, thank you for the weather. Awesome. Not necessarily to be expected in mid-April, right, in Minnesota. So very, very happy about that. Jim Bear has taught all of us that the landscape holds the stories. And I want to talk to you this morning about a story that is embedded into the very broadest and deepest landscape of our nation. 6 months ago, as Jim Bear said, we were gathered here where we co-convened the Bartimaeus Institute on the Road and the CAN annual conference. To me, it was a really significant gathering. Elaine and I saw it really as a stepping stone in our own ongoing development of conversation around settler, indigenous, immigrant identity issues in our communities of faith. And it was a great opportunity to establish and deepen a relationship with you all. So it's really wonderful to be back, to see many friendly faces. Some of you I know we didn't get a chance to meet. So I feel comfortable taking on a substantial issue this morning. This is not the kind of conversation you have with anybody, but only with your friends and your colleagues, folks who you know are in the struggle for gospel integrity and justice. I want to talk with you about this story embedded in our national landscape. Knowing that much of this will already be familiar to many of you. Nevertheless, I'm of the opinion that our discipleship communities cannot review these themes too many times as we seek to grow into what my wife Elaine would call our historical response ability. So, slide. I chose two readings from the Revised Common Lectionary for this fourth week of Easter. One was the epistle that you just heard from Revelation 7. It's a sort of a liturgical interlude just before the opening of the famous seventh seal, talked about by John the Revelator, and its multiple iterations of God's judgment on empire. The central image from this vast scene of multicultural worship, so appropriate to a church like this one, are these verses, which have to do with folks who are dressed in white, a phrase that is repeated no less than three times. The Greek term here, leukos, used in the Gospels for the transfiguration account, can also mean shining or cleansed. Slide. For the African-American community in this country, this image was, in the 19th century, famously used to refer to those struggling to escape slavery. Slide. We see a glimpse of this in the song Wade in the Water. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. Now who are those children all dressed in white? God's gonna trouble the water. Must be one of those Israelites. God's gonna trouble the wall. So I think you know this song. It's a great old Negro spiritual. But Negro spirituals, long before they were domesticated for dominant culture consumption, were coded songs of black resistance. Slide. For example, Harriet Tubman, the famous conductor of the 19th century Underground Railroad, used this song to instruct escaping slaves to get off the trail and into the water to make sure that the dogs chasing them and the slave catchers could not sniff out their scent. People walking through water, as you know, did not leave a scent trail that dogs can follow. Notice the three colors in this song: red, white, and blue. A rather searing and ironic commentary on mid-19th century America. Slide. Tubman's advice was reflected in this famous painting by Thomas Moran entitled Slave Hunt in the Great Dismal Swamp, 1862. This abolitionist piece of art depicted escaping slaves using swampland as the water to wade into, to get away from the slave catchers. This full-scale canvas depicts the desperate flight of a slave family through, it's meant to represent the Great Dismal Swamp, which extended from southeastern Virginia to the northern, northeastern coastal region of North Carolina. During the rising tide of sentiment against slavery, the image of the swamp became symbolic of the whole slavery issue for the nation in American art and literature. Even the great American poet William Wadsworth Longfellow published a famous poem called The Slave in the Dismal Swamp. This painting, shortly after this painting was produced, Abraham Lincoln began drafting the Emancipation Proclamation. Wade in the water, indeed. But of course, many of those attempting to ride the Underground Railroad to freedom 150 years ago did not make it through, but lost their lives. Which brings us back, slide, to the image in Revelation and the ironic notion of being made white in the blood, which most scholars agree refers to those who have been martyred in their witness to the gospel. And this invokes the memory of our most famous African-American martyr, slide, Martin Luther King Jr., assassinated by his own government because of his trenchant advocacy for an end to American apartheid, both racial and economic. Dr. King is, without a doubt, one of those now dressed in white under the altar of God, as depicted in this mysterious and magnificent scene in the book of Revelation. But the more difficult question is this, slide: why did we kill him? It's now 2 weeks since we commemorated the 48th anniversary of Dr. King's death. We, as a church and as a nation really still have not reckoned with his assassination. And thus, we're not fully reckoned with his legacy. I called a witness two voices of venerable American faith leaders who were contemporaries of Dr. King. Slide. One is the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, the foremost voice of Jewish peace and justice theology, who marched with Dr. King and who challenged his own community just 10 days before King's death to pay attention to King's work and witness. He is a voice, a vision, and a way, said Heschel. I call upon every Jew to hearken to his voice, to share his vision, and to follow in his way. The whole future of America will depend upon the impact and influence of Dr. King. I do not believe that Heschel overstated the case. Slide. Secondly, the witness of the late Dr. Vincent Harding, Dr. King's spiritual advisor and leading historian of the civil rights movement. Harding called King the inconvenient hero for our country and our churches, the untranquil king and his peace-disturbing vision, words, and deeds hold the key to the future of America, right? Echoing Heschel. We owe ourselves, our children, and our nation a far more serious exploration and comprehension of the man and the widespread movement with which he was identified. So these are two great spiritual elders of our nation inviting us to pay attention to this story, as it is woven through the landscape of American place and history. Slide. Unfortunately, America has instead endeavored to turn King into a toothless icon. His national holiday has become the occasion for too much pomp and too little critical reflection. Dr. King's legacy has been increasingly domesticated over the last two decades, the victim of too many street namings and prayer breakfasts at City Hall, where King's message is reduced to, "I have a dream," which can mean anything to anybody. I've learned from Dr. Harding and other elders that part of our vocation as American Christians should be to struggle to recover the prophetic character of King's vision and practice. As Heschel put it, to hearken to his voice, to share his vision, and to follow his way. Now, I believe that a sermon that Dr. King gave exactly 1 year before he was assassinated holds the key to understanding both what King stood for and why he was killed. Slide. And that is what I want to look at with you this morning in an attempt to make sense of the difficult meaning of April 4th for American history and identity. Slide. In many respects, the spring of 1967 could not have been a less opportune time for Dr. King to jump the bounds of his civil rights agenda and speak out against the escalating war in Vietnam. Most of the country was still in the grips of conservative Cold War culture. Racial segregation was still the functional norm, despite the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Meanwhile, abroad, revolutionary ferment was spreading throughout the Third World. It was spawning liberation movements whose militant ideologies represented a real challenge to King's strategic nonviolence. On the home front, the movement's backbone, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had fractured, with many of its best young leaders embracing black power and openly questioning the civil rights establishment. Slide. On top of all this, the FBI's COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, had infiltrated the civil rights movement, and Dr. King was the target of constant surveillance, constant harassment, and relentless disinformation campaigns. Slide. Through all of this, the U.S. military intervention in Indochina was escalating, and a vigorous anti-war movement was emerging. Clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam had been founded in late 1965 by Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish leaders. King would become its co-chair just a month after delivering the Riverside speech. In fact, King had first announced his opposition to the Vietnam War back in August 1965, privately to the leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But King was advised to remain quiet on the issue of Vietnam and focus on the domestic agenda of civil rights. But after President Johnson announced plans to divert funds from the war on poverty to fight a war in Vietnam, does that Sound familiar? In December of 1966, King began to reassert his criticism of the war, contending that America's involvement in Vietnam had caused the public to forget about the civil rights movement. Our wars cause us to forget about the civil rights struggle. Slide. These then were some of the forces swirling around King when he stepped into the pulpit on April 4th, 1967. He was tired, pressed in on every side, trying to navigate increasingly impossible political waters, surrounded by internal dissent, the target of a governmental conspiracy to eliminate him. Slide. Yet even in this hardest of seasons, this disciple prophet mustered the courage and conviction to speak the truth about his own country in a way that no one had before or has since. Slide. The Riverside Sermon was drafted by Vincent Harding at King's request. Dr. Harding, a mentor to many of us, passed just last year. In his later years, he gave some fascinating interviews about this, King's most consequential and, in my opinion, most enduring speech. Slide. Breaking through public silences, Dr. King began in the sermon that this breaking of silence is a vocation of agony. He understood deeply the layers of denial that characterize the American imperial consciousness. In this sermon, he outlined five reasons why he had come to oppose the war. Each is still stunningly relevant. Slide. King first lamented that the Johnson administration's war on poverty had been broken and eviscerated as if it were some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw people and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. You imagine anybody today, a well-known figure, saying something like this? Slide. King's second point, named economic conscription, the so-called poverty draft. The poor had to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem, one of his famous lines from this sermon. King recognized the cruel irony that there were more options for poor people of color in the military than in civil society. And yet, the former was reinforcing a racist foreign policy, thus adding cynicism to the process of death. Slide. The third reason that the war, that King opposed the war, is that it was teaching a new generation that violence solves conflicts. See, King had been deeply impacted by the string of urban uprisings that had been happening in the summers of 1965, Los Angeles, 1966, Chicago, Brooklyn, Cleveland, and other cities. He refers to this in some of the most powerful rhetoric of the Riverside speech about walking among angry young men and offering compassion, but they asked, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? These kinds of experiences were pushing King deeper into a focus on economic disparity. In 1967, he was already beginning to strategize for his Poor People's Campaign. And 11 months later, he would make his fateful choice to support the Memphis sanitation workers' strike. Slide. One can only imagine the flack King got for daring to name the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That's not the cuddly King you hear about on the national holiday. It's even harder to imagine a respected political or religious leader today having this sort of clarity and courage. Slide. Fourthly, King appealed to his own vocation as a civil rights leader. Slide, please. As a Nobel Peace Prize winner and as a disciple of Jesus and a child of God. In 1957, when a group of us formed the SCLC, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. That's a rather big agenda. If America's soul becomes poison, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of people the world over. So it is that those of us who are yet determined that America will be, citing the famous African-American poet Langston Hughes, are led down the path of protest and dissent, working for the health of our land. Finally, slide, King peered into the future of imperial adventurism. I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. We will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concerned committees for the next generation. They'll be concerned about Guatemala and Peru, Thailand and Cambodia, Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. Well, here we are. You see, King here was exercising his, next slide, his vocation as a true prophet, not predicting the future by gazing into a crystal ball, but rather seeing the inevitable consequences of bad national behavior. That is why. He had a list, which, by the way, is a list of countries that have indeed all endured either covert and or overt military intervention by the U.S. or its allies since 1967. He saw the future, and that's why he said, this madness must cease. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must also be ours. Dr. King sounded many other notes that resonate today in this sermon, such as his appeal for interfaith solidarity, his critique of technocracy. But the heart of his diagnosis is revealed in this slide, famous and profound passage. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and materialism are incapable of being conquered. Or as Sulgi's grandfather would put it, it's really hard to be human in America. Here, King the prophet drew together the strands learned from more than a decade of hard struggle against American apartheid, structural poverty, and endemic violence. Slide, and he insisted that it was all connected. Slide. He also made it clear that only the power of love, we sang about that this morning, only the power of love embodied in a nonviolent movement for justice and peace for everyone would save us from our collective dehumanization and from a leadership that possessed power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. That's a t-shirt for you. There was one note, slide, of optimism in this sermon in which King recognized that for the first time in American history, religious leaders were taking to the streets, Jews like Heschel, Protestants like Bill Sloan Coffin, and soon, slide, Catholics like Daniel and Philip Berrigan, who became the first Roman Catholic priests in the history of the United States to be arrested for protesting war, and who later became my mentors. King concluded this historic speech in good Baptist fashion. Slide. An altar call, a challenge to commitment. Now let us begin. Let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the children of God, and our human family waits eagerly for our response. What shall we say? The odds are too great? Shall we say that the struggle is too hard? We're thinking this right now. In our own minds and hearts. Will our message be that the forces of American life just militate against the arrival of other people as fully human and simply send our deepest regrets? Is that what we have to say as we shrug and say to Native people, sorry, we're too tired, it's too complicated? To say to the Black Lives Matter movement, too difficult, too conflict-ridden. In the midst of fragmentation, King called for unity of purpose and exhorted the movement to settle for nothing less than the transformation of our common history. Slide. 1 year later, almost to the exact hour, King was gunned down in Memphis while campaigning on behalf of low-wage workers. The government's ongoing conspiracy finally succeeded in silencing the greatest prophet in the history of our nation. April 4th, 1968. So why bring this up? Why not let this sleeping dog lie? It's because this story hangs over our landscape. It is woven through what it means to be an American. Slide. We need to keep revisiting this sermon because we have not yet learned the key integrative elements of King's catechism to understand that militarism is a war of the rich on the poor, to analyze foreign policy through the lens of race, to accept that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Our world is hostage more than ever to these giant triplets and their offspring. Issues King could not have foreseen, such as environmental degradation, resurgent human trafficking, feminism, LGBT rights. It's all there. The great temptation is to feel overwhelmed at the complexity of our public addictions and compulsions, to retreat into our private lives, to indulge in compassion fatigue, or to choose a narrow range of focus and screen everything else out. Religion often helps us do that. Slide. It was precisely such strategies of denial or withdrawal that Audre Lorde, a black lesbian feminist poet who knew a great deal about marginalization and invisibility, attacked in her famous assertion, "Your silence will not protect you." A little more than a decade after King's Riverside speech, Audre Lorde gave a talk in Chicago that powerfully echoed King's call to the vocation of agony. The transformation of silence into language and action is an act of self-revelation, she said, and it is always fraught with danger. This time she was talking to women, to gays and lesbians, to those who were still marginalized by the society. This was a community slide which in just a few years, amidst the AIDS crisis, would coin the grim slogan, "Silence equals death." But like King, her words carry an enduring relevance for all of us, slide. Lorde was one of the few activists in the years following King's death who intuitively understood and embraced the exhortation to intersectional struggle. She challenged various identity groups constantly to overcome their fragmenting differences, not by suppressing them, but by doing our own work. That's what we were trying to do here 6 months ago, to do our own work so that we can better stand with Jim Bear in the struggle of Native people. That's what was happening less than a week ago out downtown, where Steve and others stood with Black Lives Matter activists, doing their own work as white activists to stand with their black colleagues. It is not difference that immobilizes us, Audre Lorde insisted. It is silence. It is not difference that immobilizes us. It is silence. And then she talked about the fact that for all marginalized people, the machine will try to grind you into dust anyway, whether or not you speak. To stay silent is not to vanquish fear, she argued. And then she concluded, slide. We have to learn to work and speak even when we are afraid, just like we've learned to work and speak even when we're tired. That's a pastoral word. And today, sisters and brothers, we are afraid of so many things in our world, from global climate catastrophe to the most intimate of oppressions. Which brings me in conclusion to a recent example, 30 years after Lorde, 40 years after Martin, of breaking the silence as the source of our greatest strength. Slide. We're just a little over 2 months away from the first anniversary of an action that embodied the spirit of Dr. King's Riverside speech and Audre Lorde's exegesis of it. On June 27, 2015, as you know, activist Bree Newsom climbed up a flagpole in front of the South Carolina State House, and took down the Confederate flag, thus breaking decades of killing silence. She did this only 10 days, slide, after the awful murder of 9 members of Mother Emanuel AME Church, including their activist pastor, in nearby Charleston, South Carolina, by a young white supremacist, a violation that shocked the nation, but that actually represented only the worst in a long string of white attacks on black churches. Bree Newsom is a person of faith, like you and I. Slide. She's an activist who trained for months for this bold action, and she acted through her fear of the very real prospect that she would face reactive violence for breaking the greatest Southern taboo, naming a flag as racist. She reckoned with getting shot down like a crow on that pole. As she was arrested, do you know what she was reciting out loud? Our other reading for this morning, Psalm 23. Slide. It's not hard to imagine why a young black woman would have chosen this famous petition for divine protection in the valley of the shadow of death. After all, she was going up against the archetypal symbol for white Southern male power and doing so in the face of a brand new epidemic of police violence against young African Americans. Lord, prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. Slide. As she explained later, I removed the flag in defiance of the oppression that continues against black people globally in 2015. I did it for all the fierce black women on the front lines of the movement and for all the little black girls who are watching this. I did it because I am free. And in this statement, Bree went on to place herself, slide, in a long line of female freedom fighters. In her courageous action, Bree Newsom reminded us that our discipleship duty is to always find new ways to break the silences that hold us captive and that dehumanize others. Bree is not a superhero. She's just like you and me. Slide. But her action did inspire this depiction of Wonder Woman by a Jewish artist, an image that immediately went viral. You've probably seen it. Animating the imagination of thousands and thousands of those little black girls to break their silence. Slide. The Lorraine Motel, where Dr. King was gunned down 48 years and 2 weeks ago, is now the National Civil Rights Museum, thanks to a protracted community struggle to commemorate this painful event. Directly under the balcony where the dreamer took his last breath is this memorial stone, into which is etched a quote from the story of Joseph in Genesis, as you see. Its challenge haunts our nation like an unresolved chord. What will become of his dreams? Slide. The choice is ours, King closed at Riverside. And though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. And so here we are 48 years later, and the choices are still before us, and they're even more difficult and more crucial. Ever and always inviting us to work through our fear to break every silence that kills. And that is how we as a church and a nation can redeem the terrible legacy of April 4th. Slide. Next year is the 50th anniversary of the Riverside speech. And I'm working with Rachel Harding, Vincent's daughter, and Amy Butler, the current pastor at Riverside Church, on a major 50th anniversary commemoration of this most significant speech in the history of our nation on April 4th, 2017. Slide. So I want to challenge Church of All Nations and other friends here this morning. What will we do next year? Could this be a venue for a significant gathering where we sit together and reflect on this amazing sermon and try yet again to muster the courage to break our silences? I want to commend this prospect to you as a church, as colleagues. I'll be working on major gatherings all around the country, not only in Riverside, New York, but also in Denver and Los Angeles, Atlanta, and we hope right here in Minneapolis.